feeling very all-powerful up here. In the Well, I want to thank everybody for coming and our witnesses for coming. Really pleased to be talking about something that we have much agreement on, probably all agreement on, and it's extremely important to our state. I would like to extend the fact that Congressman McKinley, we invited him to join us today, was unable to be here, but I know he is as passionate about this as we are as well. And I would just like to say that a field hearing, in my view, is, you know, it is like we're right in Washington in our committee room giving the testimony. This will be part of the permanent record of the United States Senate, and I believe it's going to be online in the next 24 hours or so. So if you didn't catch something you want to catch, you can relook at it. But for the general public, I think that's important. So the way this goes is I'm going to make an opening statement, and then Senator Manchin's going to make an opening statement, and then we're going to have each person testify. If they have a larger statement, they'll give a five-minute kind of brief overview of their statement, and then we'll begin the questioning. So I don't want to make it real formal, but that's kind of how we're going to roll here. So, again, thank you all very much for coming. I'm going to gavel us in. I want to start by thanking the Mon County Justice Center for hosting us, and I'd like to thank Judge Clodge, I hope I said his name correctly, Robin Bailey, and the other Justice Court officers for going above and beyond. They greeted me and got me in perfectly fine, and I know it's a disruption to their day, so I appreciate that. And again, I want to welcome our witnesses to talk about the economic importance of energy infrastructure in the state of West Virginia. We're now at a point, I think, in the United States where the United States is becoming one of the most dominant players in energy production in the world, which makes this hearing incredibly well-timed and important. And there's arguably no other state where the discussion on energy infrastructure is more critical than in West Virginia. In 2013, the United States surpassed Russia and Saudi Arabia as the leading oil and gas producer in the world, and yet we are still woefully ill-equipped to handle this boom in production. The good news, however, is that building modern infrastructure will do exponentially more than just deliver cheap, reliable energy. New infrastructure creates jobs, and that's what we wanted to focus on today. Boosts communities and adds billions of dollars to the economy, improves the safety and reliability of our grids, and contributes to less emissions. West Virginia has always been one of the blocks in the foundation of our country's energy production, but our economy and many of our communities have been devastated due to the downturn in the coal industry. But we still continue to rank 10th in production of all energy, 10th in the production of natural gas, second in the production of coal. And West Virginia has proven time and again that we have the perfect storm, in a good way, of natural resources and skilled workforce that make investment in energy production, energy infrastructure so valuable. Advanced drilling techniques have made our natural gas wells some of the most productive in the country. Marcellus and Utica shales have accounted for 85% of the growth in the industry. In 2014, one EQT well in Wetzel County, just below Marshall County, my home of my birth, alone provided enough gas to provide the power for 77,000 homes for an entire year. That shows you how prolific. This rate of production, coupled with the fact that the gas demand for power generation alone in the lower 48 is expected to increase by almost 75% between now and 2025, means that there is crucial need for this transmission infrastructure. The shale gas revolution has made it possible to produce enough gas to meet both our domestic natural demand and increase our footprint around the world in the global oil and gas markets. The ability to export liquefied natural gas, which I've been a supporter of, means more job opportunities here as well at home as well as abroad. The export project at Cove Point is almost online, and Dominion right now has 2,000 workers. They're probably not all Dominion workers, but contractors and all, that are working on that job right now, and it will export gas to countries like Japan and India, friendly countries to us, and will considerably lessen our reliance and their reliance on hostile countries that threaten the global security. Additionally, due to the exponential increase in natural gas reserves, we will see that exports do more than just provide trade revenue. So the need for pipelines to transport our abundance of natural gas is crucial. That's why I included language in the Energy Policy Modernization Act of 2016, which is actually in conference right now, which is the most comprehensive energy legislation we've done in years, and very bipartisan. I know Senator Manchin and I both voted for that coming out of the committee and on the floor, and I, speaking for myself, hope that we can get the chance to vote for that conference committee. But my bill would help to streamline the permitting process for pipelines. We've learned that the permitting process can be so broken apart and convoluted that we can streamline it, not doing away with any of the environmental regulations of all, because those are extremely important, but just make it make more common sense. Pipeline infrastructure is critical for job creation. It is estimated that for every mile of natural gas transmission line pipeline, a total of 58 jobs is created. And because of our upstream capacity, West Virginia can have a more robust chemical sector that accounts for nearly 40% of our state's manufacturing jobs and is the second largest exporting industry in the state. So using ethane from natural gas as a feedstock means that chemical companies can choose to operate in West Virginia due to the enormous benefits of being right on top of the resource. That's why, again, I included language in the energy bill that would require the Department of Energy and Commerce to conduct a study to look at the feasibility of an ethane storage and distribution hub here in Appalachia, in West Virginia, or in the region. Congress's role in improving infrastructure is only a piece of what needs to be done. Innovation and private investment are extremely important to building safe, efficient energy infrastructure. Innovation, we're doing it here on the campus of West Virginia University and also at the National Energy Technology Lab, are extremely key. Senator Heidkamp and I have worked on a bipartisan group that we can focus on carbon capture technology, which we're going to talk about later. So we need to foster an environment where risks associated with infrastructure are vastly outweighed by the incentives to move forward. So I'm going to shorten my statement here because I'm getting longer than my 5 minutes. One of the greatest contributions to our energy infrastructure is the diversity and ingenuity of our workforce. And we're going to talk about that today. And West Virginia, as an energy exporting state, I think is a prime example of this. So I would like to, again, I hope we can accomplish a lot in the hearing today. I hope that this will give us some impetus as we move back to Washington, D.C. after Labor Day to move that conference committee bill on the energy bill. It has a lot to do with what we're going to be talking today. And I want to thank again the witnesses. Before we move to that, I would like to ask Senator Manchin for an opening statement.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I thank you for holding this hearing today. We both serve on the Energy and Natural Resource Committee, which is very important to our state and very important to this country. I just want to thank all the witnesses. I know everyone's concerned about this right now. We're hitting some tough times, and it's going to be all of us pulling together to figure this one out and working together. And we can't let politics get in between. I think you'll see the Senator Capito and myself will work across party lines and try to show a pathway forward in Washington that we should be doing what's best for our country and our states that we respectfully represent. That's what I think we do here today, and I think we will continue to do that. I want to thank all of you again. Dr. Deskins, thank you and appreciate it, and Dr. Anderson and Mr. Earl and Steve Hedrick, who we've worked with very close over the years. Mr. Keffer, I appreciate you all being here, and Delegate Poling, thank you, as always, for being involved. I also want to make a little announcement right now on Senator Capito, and I've been working very hard on this, is trying to get Secretary Manise to come to West. We finally got it confirmed, and so we've got him confirmed. He's going to be coming September the 12th. He'll be looking at Nettle. We're going to take him out to Longview. We're going to show him what we do for this country and how well we do it. So we're pleased to announce that today, that he will be coming, and that we've worked on long and hard. We had him coming earlier, but then we had the Iran nuclear discussion, if you will, that went on, and it kind of took him away from us for a while. So we've got him back, and we're happy for that. It's no secret that any of us in West Virginia have been economically challenged here recently. Our economy is suffering largely due to transition away from coal. We continue to experience persistently high unemployment rates In fact, in some counties, those numbers are over 2 times the national average. In our southern counties, traditionally our largest coal-producing region, we are consistently posting unemployment numbers in the double digits. Some of our southern counties are posting unemployment rates more than double the national average. Mingo County, 11.7%. McDowell, 12.5%. Logan, 10%. Wyoming, 9.1%. Boone, 8.3%. Workforce West Virginia reports that between July 2015, July 2016, we lost 4,800 mining and logging jobs, 700 manufacturing jobs, and 1,700 in trade, transportation, and utility jobs. The slowdown of natural gas exportation, exploration and production in Marcellus and Utica has dampened new hiring as well as state tax revenue, as we all know. To complicate matters, we just experienced a once-in-a-century flood that took West Virginia lives, homes, and businesses, a tragic event from which we will be recovering for years. More than ever, it's critical that we go the extra mile to examine the opportunities for jobs creation and economic development while ensuring we remain an energy leader for our nation. Historically, West Virginia has been an energy exporter. Our home state sits on abundant reserves of coal, natural gas, which Senator Capito has just pointed out. We're the fourth largest state of proved reserves of natural gas behind only Texas, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma. In 2016 Annual Energy Outlook, the EIA projected that even in a clean power plan scenario, coal and natural gas will make up approximately half of our electric generation mix in 2040. We talk about deniers. You know, there's those who deny that there's climate change going on. And there's those who deny that we're going to be needing fossil for the next 2, 3, or 4 decades. To me, both of them are severely handicapping us from the standpoint of doing the job that we need to be doing. And I would hope that all those on the denier of either side would look at the facts. They're entitled to their own opinions, just not entitled to their own facts. So these are the facts as we bring them forth. They're going to continue to be a critical part of our energy mix and our economy for decades to come. It's important for us, very important for us, to support the policies that ensure West Virginia continues to be significant and sustainable participant in the energy future of this nation. Two pieces of these policies simply put are technology and infrastructure. Technology, we must further develop and commercialize carbon capture, utilization, and sequestration in order to secure a future for reliable, affordable coal energy, both here and home abroad. Infrastructure, we must put the necessary infrastructure in place to take advantage of the robust opportunities that come from our abundant natural resources while ensuring the reliability of our electric grid. And I would mention one thing. I've spoken to a lot of our state legislators, and I said we've got to start thinking in terms of a regional energy hub, Mid-Atlantic energy region, such as the Southwest. We should be looking at Pennsylvania and Ohio as part of this region, not the borders that separate us, but basically the ability that we have to work together, build these pipelines that basically keep some of this product in this market area to attract it. They say build it and they will come. I truly believe if you have it, they will come, but you have to have access to it. Transportation of energy by pipeline has always been a key part of the energy economy and will be a key in its future. And when developed responsibly in harmony with local stakeholders, these projects offer our state economic benefits. The Interstate Natural Gas Association of America Foundation released a study earlier this year which noted that new investments in midstream pipeline infrastructure will range from $183 billion to $282 billion over the next 2 decades. It is no secret that pipeline development in West Virginia is growing, particularly because our region is blessed with vast amounts of this gas and natural gas liquids. We need to ensure that these high-value West Virginia products can reach new markets, and this is what we're looking at, as well as attract long-term investment in our state and our workforce. Expanding pipeline infrastructure will allow us and consumers, businesses, access to more affordable energy and a greater proximity to raw materials, which attracts new investments and leads to job creation. West Virginia's workers and businesses should have access to job opportunities associated with these infrastructure projects. And when I say job opportunities, I mean high-paying quality opportunities that offer West Virginia a means of obtaining the skills and knowledge required to cultivate a viable long-term career path. We have seen great success in our state when industry, workers, and local community and technical colleges to provide students with the skills and training that they need to succeed. For example, Toyota, West Virginia's partnership with Bridge Valley Community and Technical College, has ensured that students are learning in-demand 21st century skills that Toyota has access to a highly qualified workforce. If you haven't been down to the Southern High Tech Center, you should see it in that operation. I mean, these students are earning while they're learning, and they have a very, very, very good job waiting for them. So, in conclusion, West Virginia has helped power the nation for decades. I have said this, and I said this to the president. I've said this to all the different people in the White House. I said, if you want to know how we feel in West Virginia, we feel like a returning Vietnam veteran. We've done everything you asked us to do. We've done the heavy lifting. We've done the hard work. And now you act like you don't appreciate it and you don't respect it and you don't really think it was needed. Without West Virginia and the efforts that we've made over the last century, I assure you, we wouldn't be sitting in the freest country on earth, the superpower of the world, if it had not been for what West Virginia has contributed. And with that, I say thank you all for being here, Madam Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Manchin. And our first witness, and what I'm going to do is introduce you individually, and then you can make your statement. So Dr. Brian Anderson is the GE Plastics Material Engineering Professor in Chemical Engineering at WVU. He's also a native of Ripley, I found out. So that's a mark of excellence. And he serves as the director of the WVU Energy Institute. He graduated from WVU, and he has his advanced degrees from MIT. So I want to welcome you here, Dr. Anderson.
Senator Capito, Senator Manchin, thank you very much, and good afternoon. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today. As you mentioned, I'm Brian Anderson. I'm the director of the WVU Energy Institute at West Virginia University. The WVU Energy Institute serves to facilitate collaborative and innovative solutions to the energy future of West Virginia and the United States. And as the coordinating institution of energy research at the flagship land-grant university in West Virginia, it is central to my organization's mission to work with stakeholders within the university and across the state and region to help further that land-grant mission. A key aspect of that mission is to assist in stimulating economic development in West Virginia. As you know, the economy of West Virginia has long been grounded in the energy sector. From the early development of oil and gas resources in the United States to the long history of the coal industry, much of the economic base of West Virginia is highly dependent on the energy resources with which the state has been blessed. Almost 100 years ago, in 1921, the world's first commercial ethane cracker was built in Clendenin, West Virginia, due to the proximity of liquid-rich natural gas production in the Elk and Kanawha River valleys. This development spurred on the modern petrochemical and plastic industry that we have today. Due to the abundance and proximity of the natural resources in the U.S. Gulf Coast, however, much of the expansion of the petrochemical industry and plastics industry has occurred in that region over the past half century. However, with advances in horizontal drilling and hydraulic stimulation techniques, first developed in part by research done in Morgantown, West Virginia, at what is now the Department of Energy's National Energy Technology Laboratory, we are again now realizing abundant resources of natural gas and natural gas liquids in this region. The Marcellus Shale is now the largest producer of natural gas in the United States, and the Utica Shale shows similar, if not more, prolific potential. These two shales in the region are not only producing large volumes of natural gas, but also of natural gas liquids such as ethane, propane, and butane. Ethane and propane are the raw materials used to make pharmaceuticals, industrial chemical, and consumer goods. Over the last 10 years, production of ethane and propane in the Marcellus and Utica shales have driven the cost of these very valuable raw materials to a price point well below global and national prices. Connecting this valuable resource to the national and global markets will take modern, robust infrastructure, the topic of this hearing. I contend that the types of infrastructure necessary to benefit both the region and the nation is not only a reliable, modern network of pipelines, but also a robust regional system of natural gas liquid storage and distribution. Recently, Royal Dutch Shell Chemical Appalachia announced a final investment decision on building a multi-billion dollar ethane cracker in Pennsylvania, not far from the West Virginia border. Shell has said that constructing the plant would employ about 6,000 workers and provide 600 permanent operational positions when it opens. Shell, which has been pulling back in parts of its global operations, said that this facility was a particularly competitive project because it will use ethane from the Appalachian Basin, the lowest cost shale gas basin in North America. The Shell ethane cracker will consume about 105,000 barrels of ethane per day, producing 1.6 million tons of polyethylene pellets per year to be molded into consumer products and packaging. Two other companies are now examining the potential to join Shell and investing billions of dollars into this region and creating thousands of manufacturing jobs due to the proximity and abundance of the natural resources in the Appalachian Basin. Each of these other facilities would use another 50 to 100,000 barrels per day of ethane. With current ethane production rates in the basin at around 500,000 barrels per day, the resource is certainly sufficient to support a renewed and robust chemical industry. That is, as long as there is modern and robust energy transportation infrastructure to support that. Last October, in a regional effort, as mentioned by Senator Manchin, the governors of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio signed a regional cooperation agreement titled, The Agreement to Enhance Regional Cooperation and Job Growth Through the Continuing Development of Shale Gas in the Appalachian Basin. In this agreement, four primary areas of cooperation were identified: marketing and promotion, workforce development, transportation and infrastructure, and research. As part of the agreement, the states are working together to support infrastructure like pipelines, railroads, and roadways critical to shipping natural gas and natural gas-related products. In addition, they are encouraging the state-sponsored universities, such as us, to collaborate on research to find appropriate end uses for natural gas products. They will also collaborate on preparing for emergency response, promoting recycling and environmentally friendly practices in the industry, as well as supporting entrepreneurship. The WVU Energy Institute is playing a key role in each of these four areas in that Tri-State Agreement. In particular, we are leading an effort involving the state geologic surveys of these three states, as well as an industry consortium currently with 12 members, also funded by the Claude Worthington Denham Foundation, to examine the geologic potential for safe and reliable subsurface storage of natural gas liquids. The goal of this project is to provide essential data to support the development of the chemical manufacturing industry, promoting economic development. As evidenced by the industry's commitment to our project, developing storage and transportation infrastructure is a critical pathway to developing the industry in the region. Subsurface storage and distribution and a network of pipelines will benefit both the raw material producers, the upstream oil and gas industry, as well as the chemical industry by fostering a readily available and reliable network and source of natural gas liquids, developing a predictable price point of the commodity in the region. Currently, there is only one spot pricing hub for natural gas liquids in the United States, and it's on the Gulf Coast. And thirdly, promoting regional investment and a more robust ecosystem for the industry. It's all critical to establish a reliable trading hub into which producers can sell their products. The primary example of an ethane storage hub and associated pipeline in the United States exists in between Brownsville, Texas, and Lake Charles, Louisiana. The piping and infrastructure this infrastructure encourages the growth in this region due to its interconnectivity to multiple manufacturing facilities in the vicinity. In conclusion, many projects at various stages of development are underway to build takeaway capacity from this region, moving the raw materials to the East Coast, to the Gulf Coast, and to Canada. However, to spur on a more diverse national economy, a robust regional infrastructure is necessary. Advances in technology have provided us with an opportunity to implement best-in-class construction and monitoring techniques to ensure the safe operation of natural gas liquid storage facilities as well as pipeline infrastructure. So regional and national collaboration is essential to the development of this reliable and robust interstate energy infrastructure. The states of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio have already begun collaborating to erase these state borders, and we look forward to working with our federal counterparts in this exciting effort. And so, Senator Capito and Senator Manchin, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify today, and I look forward to answering any questions you have.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next witness is Dr. John Deskins, and he is the director at the Bureau for Business and Economic Research at WVU. He focuses primarily on state economic development, small business economics, government and tax expenditure policies at the state level, and he has a PhD in economics. So welcome, Dr. Deskins.
Senator Capito, Senator Manchin, thank you so much for inviting me to appear before you today. It's truly an honor to be here to discuss the importance of a modern, reliable energy infrastructure for the West Virginia and national economy. By any measure, West Virginia is an energy state. For example, energy accounts for 17% of economic output in the state, making it the state's largest industrial super sector. Energy jobs are among the highest paying jobs in the state, often by far. Coal is our largest export commodity, and natural gas is poised to become another key export commodity. Severance tax revenue from energy is vital to our state and local governments. The deep decline in coal production that has occurred in recent years has had a devastating effect on our state's economy. Coal production has dropped to an expected 70 million tons for this year, down 56% from its 2008 level. This has led to a loss of 13,000 coal jobs and a direct loss of $4 billion in economic output. For 2015, West Virginia's total economic output was lower than in 2011. These losses create a vicious cycle where we see continuing population loss, an aging population, drug abuse, and so on, making it even more challenging to attract new business to West Virginia and therefore continuing that vicious cycle. Some may read the numbers associated with declining coal output and imagine that the losses are spread across the coal-producing regions of the nation. We have seen a national drop in the demand for coal caused by a perfect storm of three factors. But the effect of this drop in demand has been felt most strongly in the region with the lowest coal mine worker productivity, Central Appalachia, which of course includes southern West Virginia. There we have been mining the region's hotter burning and cleaner coal deposits for well over a century, such that the coal that remains is generally deeper in the ground in thinner seams and more expensive to extract. So in Central Appalachia, coal production has fallen by 51% since 2010, compared to a decline of 10% for the nation's other coal-producing regions. 51% versus 10%. Coal production in northern West Virginia, part of the northern Appalachian coal seams, has generally been stable. Correspondingly, nearly all of the coal job losses that have occurred in West Virginia have come from our state's southern coal fields. The concentration of these job losses has created a great depression in six counties, two of which Senator Manchin mentioned a second ago. But the six are Boone, Clay, Logan, McDowell, Mingo, and Wyoming. Job losses over the past 4 years range between 25% and 33% in each of these counties. Consider Boone County, our state's largest coal-producing county for many years. Their coal production and employment stand at around 30% of their 2010 levels. Statistics are beginning to show other losses in the county as less money is flowing to other local businesses, grocery stores, entertainment venues, etc. Losses in coal severance tax revenue have led to a severe public school layoff in the county. The industrial mix of these counties also lends to the crisis. In Boone County in 2010, coal accounted for 55% of all the jobs in the county, making it difficult, if not impossible, for many laid-off coal miners to find alternative employment locally. My point is, the heavy concentration of losses in coal output and employment is far worse than would be the case if the losses were widely dispersed. The current situation gives rise to the question of whether these affected communities are sustainable over the long run. The natural gas boom that West Virginia has enjoyed has helped, for sure. The boom created around 3,000 high-paying jobs between 2010 and 2015. Many of those jobs have been lost since early 2015 due to a slowdown in natural gas drilling, but a return to growth is expected in coming years. And while it is beneficial for our state in many ways, natural gas extraction is very capital intensive and as such is unlikely to employ the number of workers needed to ensure broad prosperity. Broad prosperity associated with natural gas will require more downstream activity, creating more value added and more jobs. Many call for industrial diversification as the solution to West Virginia's economic crisis. I myself make this call routinely in speeches and discussions across the state. It is crucial for West Virginia to cultivate strength in manufacturing, tourism, and other industries. However, industrial diversification is a long-run proposition which requires long-term action on the part of businesses, entrepreneurs, government, and community leaders. A more viable path for West Virginia in the short run is through strengthening our state's energy sector. As I believe all of these figures indicate, this is desperately needed for our economy. And while many of the factors affecting energy in West Virginia are outside of the reach of policymakers, I hope the information provided here today can certainly help move our energy sector forward and our overall economy forward and help turn around this vicious cycle that plagues our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next witness is Mr. Chad Earle. Chad is the Director of Marketing and Business Development for Orders Construction Company in St. Albans, West Virginia, and has been there since 2013. He's a lifelong West Virginian, and he has an extensive background in infrastructure development. He's also a member of the 2016 Leadership West Virginia class. Welcome, Chad. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for this invitation, and it's truly an honor to come before you today to discuss my perspective and how important the energy industry and infrastructure development is to my family, our company, and all of West Virginia. Let me begin by saying I am a proud and lifelong West Virginian. I grew up in Greensville, which is a rural community in Calhoun County, and started helping my dad take care of well wells whenever I was about 12 years old. I graduated from Wilton State College and worked my way through college as a pipeliner and environmental technician there in Glenville. So when I think about it, the energy industry, particularly the oil and gas industry, has had a huge positive effect on my life. It gave my family the ability to support me and my brothers. Now it's given me the opportunity, and many others like me, the ability to support their families and have promising careers. I'm active in several professional organizations related to construction, manufacturing, and the energy industries, all of which are affected by a reliable infrastructure that we're here to discuss today. As I said, I'm a native West Virginian. In fact, I share many of the same opinions and belief about West Virginia that I've heard Senator Capito and Manchin mention on several different occasions. I'm sure they will agree with me when I say the beauty of our state is immeasurable. Our natural resources are abundant, but it's the people from every corner of the state that's our greatest strength. Our people are intelligent and hardworking and very passionate about their communities. They are proud of the heritage of belonging to one of the highest energy-producing states in the nation. We want to live here, and we want to stay in West Virginia. We want to stay home, and we want the opportunity for our children to live here and stay home if they choose to do so. In order for this to happen, we need to create an economic environment that allows for growth. We need to have this opportunity with the natural gas industry. To be clear, shale gas is revitalizing West Virginia's economy. I serve as the Director of Business Development for Orders Construction Company. We are a family-owned business and been in business since 1964 and have expanded from a bridge-building contractor in our early days to a trusted, reputable, and dependable construction company that spans many different business segments of the economy. Our markets include state and federal highways, manufacturing facilities, chemical and industrial complexes, water and waste plants, and energy companies as well. Our group employs approximately 400 people with very good jobs, and most salaries are well above the national average. Because of the increased activity in the oil and gas fields, we have been able not only to retain the labor force that supports us, but consistently add jobs and grow our business. This is more than important. It is vital to our local economies and the families that live here, especially when you look at the decline of the coal industry and the economic devastation from Southern West Virginia. I can point to over 50 positions within our company that have been created as just to support the shale industry alone. We can continue to grow only if the energy industry remains strong, because it impacts all businesses in West Virginia. It affects our tax base for roads and schools. It affects chemical and manufacturing industry, because it brings in raw materials and energy supply. It impacts other small businesses such as restaurants, gas stations, hotels, school band, the football team. All of them get money from the gas industry. So it's no secret that in West Virginia our communities prosper when the energy industry is robust. Expanding our energy infrastructure will create jobs, it will strengthen our communities, it will help attract manufacturing to the region. Above all else, it will give this region of the country a little hope that our elected leaders are working with us and not the activists who have dedicated their agendas to help hinder progress, because they work every day to try to put small businesses like ours out of business. Each state in the country makes use of its resources. Massachusetts uses fishing. Midwest has flat fields has farming. Florida attracts tourists to its beaches for warm weather. West Virginia can harvest the massive gas deposits under it for the benefit of its people for decades to come. However, it won't happen without the support of government policies that allow it to be done and done properly. Pipelines and energy production will continue to make us more stable from other regions of the world. The pipelines we build are more than pipelines. They are highways that deliver a required resource to the end users, families, manufacturing facilities, and other small businesses, as well as schools and hospitals. They're the safest and most economical long-term transportation option available today. Senators, make no mistake, shale is revitalizing West Virginia. Shale is providing small, family-owned businesses like ours with the opportunity they need to bring this raw material to market, and will continue to enhance our energy security and independence. The men and women of West Virginia are industry professionals. Our history is that of an energy-producing state. Please help our people strengthen the state economy and help us produce and transport energy in our region that we so desperately need. Thank you very much for the
Thank you, Chad. Our next witness is Mr. Steve Hedrick. Steve is the president and CEO of Mid-Atlantic Technology Research and Innovation Center, known as Matrix, in South Charleston, West Virginia. He has more than 20 years in the petrochemical industry, leading businesses, chemical manufacturing, and in his capacity as president and CEO, he helps Matrix deliver market-driven innovation, research, and technical engineering. Welcome, Mr. Hedrick, and glad to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Senator, and thank both of you for the opportunity to appear before you before the committee today. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for the opportunity to all of you. As was mentioned, my name is Steve Hedrick, and I'm President and Chief Executive Officer at Matrix, a strategic innovation partner that provides deep, uncommon expertise in research and development infrastructure to solve the most challenging problems in the areas of science and technology. We're proudly based in Charleston, West Virginia, and have a division here in Morgantown, West Virginia. I'm also a West Virginia native, and we've been through good times and bad, and seemingly more bad lately, but we've shown resilience. And I'm a firm believer, whether you're running a business, a state, a country, a certain level of resilience is a pivotal component to success. So one of the greatest ancient historians, Thucydides, once said, "The bravest are surely those who have the clearest vision of what is before them, glory and danger alike, and yet notwithstanding, go out to meet it." And thinking about why we're here today, we're talking about this region, our state, our country, the future, the gift of energy below our feet. We are prepared to go out and meet the most challenging demands that our country can face, and to do so from a position of authority. And what generates that position of authority, of course, is manufacturing, which is the cornerstone of West Virginia's future. And while we've seen apparent progress, we've yet to even begin to scratch the surface of the possibilities. But we know our vision. It is clear, and there is glory to be found for our citizens and their families, for our nation, when we achieve that vision. But first, we need to realize our own new reality, because frankly, if we don't, we'll never get out of this rut. So how do we do this? Investing in innovation and R&D and key assets like the West Virginia Regional Technology Park is a must. There are keys to high-tech jobs for the Quad State region represented by Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky. But the real reason we're all here today, of course, is infrastructure and energy. We cannot take advantage of the Utica, Rogersville, and Marcellus Shale opportunity without infrastructure to support the demands of the associated industries. Infrastructure requirements associated with the new buildouts must be delivered by multiple parties. Now, it will not be easy and it won't be cheap. We'll need cooperation and support from the federal and state governments, private equity, and existing business platforms, all to their mutual benefit. Now, you may be asking yourself, what about Royal Dutch Shell's announcement earlier this month and its intentions to build a three-state ethane pipeline system to feed its Monaca, Pennsylvania cracker? Aren't they already doing this? Well, the answer is yes, but no. This decision clearly demonstrates the necessity for specific infrastructure for Shell to be successful, and that they can't wait for a public-private partnership. But let me confirm, it does not even begin to satisfy the need for infrastructure for the petrochemical industry to expand or to increase the demand side of the highly valuable and readily available natural gas liquids in this region. And more specifically, this announcement does not satisfy the need for ethane offtake for a natural gas industry, as Dr. Anderson mentioned a moment ago. There's simply too much ethane available for this single investment to advantage our nation to its maximum potential. This cracker from Royal Dutch Shell and its associated pipeline has an estimated capacity of about 100,000 barrels a day. Rather than exporting additional ethane available via pipeline to the United States Gulf Coast, Europe, Asia, or even Canada, it could be utilized here in the Appalachian Basin, here in America, to maximize the value potential of our raw materials. According to the publication Natural Gas Intelligence, ethane accounts for more than 50% of the typical NGL barrel in the Appalachian region. And with exports now leaving Marcus Hook near Philadelphia, ethane production has been increasing in the region. In fact, midstream company MPLX's CEO, Gary Heminger, recently said, "With incremental ethane takeaway projects and the projected completion of a regional cracker facility, we anticipate reaching full utilization of our existing facilities." In other words, we need more infrastructure, and companies like Shell need more elasticity in the supply chain in order to maximize the benefit of ethane. Now, we would propose that the corridors naturally created by the Ohio and Kanawha Rivers be utilized as a platform for a substantial pipe system that will support the distribution of key raw material and intermediate constituents. including but not limited to methane, ethane, ethylene, propane, propylene, and chlorine, all of which are significant building blocks to the petrochemical industry and hence our society. We therefore must have substantial underground storage of the highest value and broadly used raw materials, specifically ethane, ethylene, and propane, and butane if we're able, and create a built-for-purpose Appalachian storage hub. This can be safely and efficiently done in naturally occurring underground caverns, in depleted natural gas extraction points, or even in depleted salt domes. In fact, the brightest minds in geological formations are currently studying the best locations for the hub. It is time for this to be done and done right to enable growth and prosperity for our citizens, our economy, and our way of life. It's time for leadership, even boldness, and decades of incredible value creation for generational opportunity to be brought to fruition. I urge you to show your resilience and reinvest in our great nation through innovation and infrastructure to secure the success of another generation. I urge you, as Thucydides once wrote, to go out and meet this challenge and assure the investment in innovation and infrastructure by the public sector, by the federal government, and supporting state governments that have the courage to do so as well. We should all do our part to make this happen, and each of you can count on me and on Matrix to do our part. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our next witness is Mr. Jeffrey Keffer. He is the president and CEO of Longview. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You did.
Thank you.
You did.
With a name like Capito, you know.
We all, from West Virginia.
Yes. he is the president and CEO of Longview Power, located in Maidsville, West Virginia. He has more than 32 years of experience in the power generation industry. I was lucky enough to tour your facility just in the recently, and was amazed to see the good work that you're doing. But he continues to oversee the strategic management and business operations of Longview Power and MEPCO. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Capito, Senator Manchin. I want to start by thanking you both for bringing the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources to Morgantown today to talk about such an important topic for our state of West Virginia. And earlier this year, both of you visited our plant and also took the time to meet with our employees, which they were very pleased with. Thank you. I'm here to report that the sunset on the coal-fired generation industry is highly exaggerated, and the model for the future of coal-fired generation in this country is a few short miles from here in Maidsville, West Virginia, at the Longview Power Plant. Longview is 4 years young, while the average age of the PGM coal-fired fleet is 45 years. The plant initially cost $2.1 billion to build, the largest private investment in West Virginia history, and last year we invested another $120 million to make the plant highly reliable. Longview now reliably produces enough electricity for 700,000 homes, while being the lowest cost coal-fired generator in PJM and the most efficient as measured by the lowest heat rate of any coal plant in North America. The plant also has exceptionally low emissions and zero wastewater discharge to surface waters. Now, Longview is able to achieve these milestones through its state-of-the-art technology. In 2015, Longview made repairs and improvements to its boiler, its fuel and air controls, it replaced its control system, and made a number of changes to its emission systems, all of which improved reliability. And since last November, when we completed all that work, the plant has been available to produce electricity 98% of the time. With this exceptional reliability and our highly effective emission systems, we're able to remove targeted pollutants, including NOx, SO2, and PM, particulate matter, to well below the very stringent permitted levels for our plant. And we also reduce CO2 emissions without adversely affecting costs or efficiency. Now, coal is not the only fuel required for coal-fired power plants to run. Secondary fuel is required to start up. And at Longview, we use natural gas supplied from the local gas distribution company when it's available. And we've talked about the constraints that we're dealing with in this state in terms of the availability of natural gas where we need it. So at Longview, in order to ensure that we had gas available to start up during peak seasons, like the wintertime, we installed a unique LNG system, the largest mobile LNG system in the United States, in order to start up the plant when the pipeline capacity is constrained. This allows us to meet the very strict PJM capacity performance requirements. And when pipeline gas is available, we've been able to demonstrate that we can co-fire with up to 20% natural gas, further increasing the plant's efficiency and reducing its emissions. Now, Longview's coal supplier is MEPCO, its affiliated coal company, and the coal is supplied by a 4.5-mile conveyor. Through its full integration with its fuel source and combustion byproducts disposal facility, Longview achieves best-in-class results and produces low-cost electricity while minimizing environmental and community impacts. Longview is a major employer and economic driver in northern West Virginia. Longview and MEPCO together employ over 600 workers, providing well-paying jobs with combined annual payroll and benefits of $72 million. We not only purchase our coal locally and limestone locally, we purchase over $105 million per year of goods and services from local and regional vendors, and we make almost $8 million in pilot and local tax payments annually. Now, Longview is demonstrating the future of coal-fired electrical generation. With its best-in-class coal combustion technology and gas co-firing capability, Longview proves that replacing the existing 45-year-old coal fleet with modern, highly efficient, advanced coal plants can greatly improve our coal plant efficiency, reliably produce low-cost electricity, and lower conventional and CO2 emissions. New advanced coal plants in West Virginia and other coal-dependent states could require the hiring of thousands of construction workers and could incorporate proven design improvements and use higher BTU fuel from Appalachia to produce and export electricity to energy-dependent states. Designing new plants to co-fire with natural gas would further increase efficiencies and reduce conventional and CO2 emissions to levels that would help to meet national climate change goals, as is being demonstrated in Germany and Japan as we speak. If we can achieve this, we do not need to retrain miners and workers, but keep them working at the well-paying jobs they know well. All of the 600 employees at Longview and MEPCO are paid highly competitive salaries. By building modern, advanced, highly efficient coal-fired plants, we would keep thousands of middle-class jobs in the region, maintain the stability of our electrical generation and delivery system, and provide the low-cost, reliable electric power necessary to support homes and manufacturing in the USA. Longview demonstrates what modern, clean coal fired power plant design and operation can achieve. Longview should be the future of coal, low cost, very clean, and highly reliable. Now, I want to thank you very much, and I commend our story to you for your consideration and your deliberations in Washington. It's a great plant, and we're very proud of what it's doing here in West Virginia. It sets a standard for not just the U.S., but for the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thank you. And our final witness is Mr. Dan Poling. He is the business manager, secretary, treasurer of the District Council 53 International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. He has 43 years of experience in the construction industry. Prior to his current position, he completed a U.S. Department of Labor registered apprenticeship class and worked as a craftsman for 25 years in the field before becoming an instructor. Welcome, Mr. Poling.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Capito, Senator Manchin, for bringing this important issue to us here in West Virginia, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on this. I want to talk about the important topic we have here, examining the economic importance of modern, reliable energy infrastructure to West Virginia and the United States. And as you mentioned, as a business manager for Painters District Council 53, I represent 1,800 painters and allied trades in West Virginia and the surrounding counties around the borders. In addition, I'm here today representing 20,000 construction workers affiliated with West Virginia State Building and Construction Trades Council, where I also serve as vice president. And as such, I want to thank both of you for your continued support of the trades, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to work with you and the support you've shown our members. Construction jobs relating to any industrial or commercial project in our state are critical to the economic future. Energy jobs, in particular, the manufacturing of electricity from coal, wind, hydro, natural gas, or other resources, make up a substantial portion of our work, our members and contractors, year in and year out. Many people refer to construction jobs as temporary, and while that may be true in part, I would like to emphasize that thousands of construction workers earn their livelihood in the energy sector every year in occupations other than mining, drilling, and facility operations. And as they talk about temporary, I myself, as I said, completed an apprenticeship back in 1973. I began and completed in 76. And I've worked temporary jobs ever since. And always been gainfully employed. And I have over 70,000 hours as a temporary worker. So if that's temporary, we need maybe more of that. And at that time, I've had health insurance, you know, and have a retirement to fall back on. So I like to talk about the available skill of supply, skilled, drug-free construction workers, what it does for our state. First, the social infrastructure enhances projects, new projects. Companies want to know their project will build on time and within budget. If companies are looking for skilled, qualified, drug-free workers in West Virginia, we only need to know how many and when do you want them to start. Second, having local workers on the job maximizes the economic impact of projects. Local workers spend their paychecks in the communities, pay into training and apprenticeship programs, have health insurance, retirement funds, and in general infuse the local economy with funds. When workers from outside the region are used on construction projects, there's a leakage of economic activity to other regions, and that negatively impacts our communities. The labor component on a typical construction project is 25%. That means 25% of every dollar spent on a project, like a school or a bridge, goes to paying wages and benefits on average. On mega industrial projects, such as an ethane cracker that is very capital intensive, expect the labor component to be a third of a third. For that, it means if it's a $6 billion project is announced, we expect $666 million to be spent on wages. $666 million. That's a lot of paychecks. A lot. So paying attention to where paychecks from our energy projects land is critical to a healthy local economy. Finally, I'd like to mention our robust apprenticeship method of training workers for the construction trade. Apprenticeship is more than on-the-job training. It includes related hands-on training at 29 training centers in and around West Virginia. Programs cover a variety of occupations from boilermakers to sheet metal workers. These programs are private sector partnerships between trade unions and construction employers. Apprentices learn while they earn and at no cost to the apprentice or the taxpayer. Together we have developed the best way to create the most productive, highly skilled worker in the world. Approximately 10% of our workforce is in the apprenticeship programs, which range from a 3 to 5 year commitment. We'd like to see that number increase to 20%. Given a commitment to hire locally, we certainly would be able to accomplish that goal. Such an increase would mean 4,000 apprentices per year getting the skills for a lifetime career. 4,000. That's a community technical college. In conclusion, the energy sector remains a vital construction job creator for our economy. The growth of the natural gas industry has provided many needed jobs to local construction workers, building pipelines and gas processing facilities. We anticipate groundbreaking on a new gas-fired electric generating facility in Mountville later this year. Major pipeline projects are just a step away from completing their regulatory review. We're currently building a wind project in Grant County and recently completed a hydro project on the Ohio River. Our workers continue to work on repair and modernization projects at many coal-fired power plants throughout the year, every year. We're excited about the jobs and ethane cracker, hopefully two or three in the region could bring, and the jobs such a project would create downstream as well. I thank you all for inviting me here, and I appreciate the opportunity to be part of this panel and to serve with these honorable speakers here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all of you. And with that, we'll kind of go to the question phase. I will start and keep mine to five, and then we'll go to Senator Manchin, and then we can go back and forth. I just, Dr. Anderson, let me ask you a question. I'm really interested in this storage possibility for this for the Appalachian region. Could you just tell me and others, how many present day storage units are there now for natural gas? There's one in, what is it, in Texas or?
Well, for natural gas liquids is what we're right. specifically talking about. It's really there's the large scale storage facilities in Texas, mm-hmm. and Mont Belvieu, Texas, just northeast of, mm-hmm. of Houston. There are smaller storage facilities around the country, but the Mont Belvieu facility is the only one that is large enough to warrant a natural gas liquids trading price point.
And then is there one in Canada, too, or no?
Actually, I'm not sure.
No. Okay. Well, in terms of the future, I mean, if we, in my view, to develop and create and keep the jobs in and around our region, we have to have something like this, or all we're going to do is build pipelines to send it somewhere else. I mean, would you agree with that?
That's right. That's why we're proposing and working on. So Steve Hedrick mentioned the Appalachian Storage Hub geologic project, and that's what we're leading with the three state surveys, specifically to try to lower the barriers to private industry and building the storage facilities in this region.
Do you know if the one that was built in Texas was a public-private partnership, or do you know how that was financed?
My understanding is it was over the course of time. And
Mr. Hedrick, do you have a comment on that?
Yes, ma'am, it was. It was, as I understand it, a public-private partnership established after the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was put in place and the salt domes were, or the salt strata was well understood then northeast of Houston, and it began the extraction of the salt to allow for the storage of the liquid ethane at that time.
According to your statement, we already have some of the geological, because we have some abandoned wells, we have some salt mines. I mean, is this a natural fit for Westford, for the region? I know it's not just West Virginia, but for the region?
It's a natural fit for the region, certainly. As an example, there are natural gas extraction points, methane extraction points in the state of West Virginia that are utilized as elasticity points for the northeastern U.S. during any given summer, you see them growing. During winter, you see them falling normally. Mm-hmm. When it's nice and cold during the winter. There's also salt strata reaching from the Great Lakes across the state of Ohio down to the vicinity of New Martinsville, West Virginia, in fact. They could avail us with the opportunity to do exactly what we've done at Mont Belvieu. And there are other areas. I'm not a geologist, mm-hmm.
Well, I want to be very supportive of that. I mean, I put that amendment into the energy bill to be supportive of this project because I think it could bear real fruit for the state of West Virginia. Mr. Earle, let me make another statement about that. There is a movement of keep it in the ground across the country I think would be crossways with what we're trying to develop here in terms of a storage basin. I think there's some people that think that if you keep it in the ground, you can just bring it up as rapidly as you may need it. That, I guess, is an unlikely scenario. You need that storage basin to be able to multiply the petrochemical and other industries close by. Could you speak to that?
So the about 85% of the natural gas that's in the ground is methane. And what we're talking about is the 15% that's not methane. Mm-hmm. And so what's necessary is to bring it out of the ground, fractionate it or de-ethanize it, separate the natural gas liquids on the surface, and then that's the raw material feedstock for the manufacturing and petrochemical mm-hmm. industry. Once you separate it and you have the 85% that's methane, that's what we use to produce power or heat homes. And so it is necessary to bring it up, separate it, and then store it as the natural gas.
Have it ready. Another thing that I have in the energy bill is streamlining on the regulatory thing. Mr. Earle, I know Orders Construction does a lot of energy work, but also a lot of transportation work. Talk to us a little bit about the permitting. I know that in the transportation bill we both voted for, we tried to streamline the regulatory regime there. Has that been working? And in my scenario, we would have FERC be the lead agency. We would try to move these things side by side, have definite deadlines and those kinds of things, and reporting, public reporting on how far along we are on the permitting process. Can you speak to that just generally?
There's so many different agencies that a producer has to report to.
Mm-hmm.
It could be streamlined and helped out quite a bit. I mean, you have Office of Oil and Gas, DEP, EPA, Water and Waste. It's just a continuing list. It's almost overbearing whenever they have to go through and fill out all these permits and get them in hand before we can start work.
Right, and in that case, time is money. If you have a permit application in and you don't get permitted for 5 years, it's exponentially increased the cost.
Yes.
And I think that's a consideration without foregoing any of the environmental regulations. I think we could do a much better job.
Yeah, correct. And you know, whenever these guys are building wells now, I mean, they're $7 million a pop. So, you know, they are regulated internally as well as externally.
Right. Right. Senator Manchin?
Thank you. Again, thank all of you for your statements in that. And I'll start with Dr. Deskins. Doctor, your economic report 2016 went into us being into a downturn, which is an understatement. And what I would like to, I think, clarify is that the downturn that we've had in energy, especially in our coal industry, which has a large trail of employment that's hard to replace even by the onslaught of the new gas finds that we've had. I think you acknowledge that in your report, too. How do you put, when you look at basically our rapid downturn of the coal industry, was it market forces? Was it basically the EPA overreach, overregulation, or accelerating that? Where do you put the concern? And then also, how do we get reinvestments back into the energy market?
Sure. Thanks for that question. I think what we saw with coal was really a perfect storm. In my report, I said three factors. I think we have the natural gas boom, which is critical, vital importance in terms of putting downward pressure on coal. I think that works in conjunction with the regulatory climate. In my view, you know, coal had a cost advantage at one point in the past. Here's the cost of coal. Here's the cost of natural gas. Natural gas boom lowers the cost of natural gas from the perspective of an electric power producer. The regulatory climate raises the cost of burning coal. So both of those together are working to tip the scale away from coal in favor of natural gas from the perspective of so many electricity producers. It's really hard to say how much is due to one versus how much is due to the other. That would really require an in-depth analysis at the power plant level. But the two are working together, and the two are both very important. And a third piece of that puzzle is the export climate. Globally, economic growth is down. Europe is smaller now than it was in 2007 in terms of economic output. China is slower. Brazil, Russia. Slower economic growth globally means less demand for steel. That means less demand for West Virginia coal exports. So those three things came together at the same time, put tremendous downward pressure on national demand. But then, as I said as well, that's not spread all the way across America. That demand is affecting central Appalachia, southern West Virginia, particularly hard. But the second part of your question was, how do we turn this around? I don't know all the answers, but I know that it is absolutely crippling West Virginia. Natural gas is positive, obviously, but just from extraction, it's not creating nearly enough jobs to replace the lost coal jobs. We have to talk about midstream activities and downstream activities, bringing those in the state as well. That's the only way we're going to be able to get enough.
So anybody that thinks that basically just us having all this wonderful find of natural gas, whether it be Utica, Marcellus, wet, whatever, is never going to replace what we've had in the coal industry unless we're able to get the downstream investments.
That is my opinion.
The storage that we're talking about, basically, all these different things, which leads into my next question, is going to be either to Dr. Anderson, Dr. Hedrick, or Steve Hedrick, whoever. But are you looking at gas as a base load? I mean, the only thing I ever understood as a base load was coal and nuclear. Because you couldn't interrupt it. It was there.
Right.
Gas is still interruptible no matter what you do with the pipeline. So is it going to be looked at from transmission as a base load?
It is. We've seen the shift of our neighboring states, the balance between coal and natural gas. And nationally, we've seen natural gas overtake coal as a base load. Right now, just recently...
How does that affect the transmission, basically our reliability of the system?
It puts additional load on the natural gas infrastructure and on the pipelines distributing our gas. And we see projects that are underway in taking gas from the Appalachian Basin across our mountains in West Virginia and Virginia and North Carolina to deliver the natural gas that is now increasingly going into power plants in Virginia. Duke Energy just got into the rate base in Virginia. A natural gas power plant, extremely efficient in the CO2 footprint that's lower than the CPP standards.
Steve, you might want to talk real quick on why are we such a, we locate essentially for this type of storage that could really help bring more of that product or keep that product in this in this area.
Thank you, Senator, for that question. We are located within two-thirds of the population of the United States of America and one-third of that of Canada. That's been a day's drive, easy travel for transportation of material goods, finished goods like this bottle that's sitting in front of me. It would be perfect for that to occur. It's also geographic diversification from the United States Gulf Coast, away from natural disasters that are naturally occurring, called hurricanes, of course. I feel very sad, of course, for the people in Louisiana who've had to deal with a flood just like we have in West Virginia within the last 6 weeks or so. But it's to great detriment of industry as well. And the trillion-dollar hits that we take in the economy sequentially every hurricane season, because it shut everything down because the hurricane rolls into the Gulf, that can, that can be smoothed out, if you will, by virtue of bringing an Appalachian storage hub to this Appalachian basin.
Jeff, do you want to just finish up real quick?
Senator Manchin, just to add to this, because obviously we're producing power, selling it into PJM, we look closely at what our competition is. Our competition really is now new gas-fired power plants that are being built throughout the region, taking advantage of the opportunity that exists because of the abundance of gas. But by the time we anticipate, by the time you get many of those plants, I think there's like 35 or whatever in the queue at this point, many of those get built, plus with the crackers in place and the other opportunities to use gas, the question will then be, or the issue will then be, where does gas go? Gas has been historically a very volatile fuel and can be very expensive when there are constraints, such as when the polar vortex occurred a couple of years ago. In fact, there just wasn't gas, believe it or not, during that period of time, and so there were many plants that couldn't operate. So there is an opportunity there for base load, and I think it's really part of the mix, and it really needs to be part of a regional mix, as you were describing, in terms of power production. There's no reason why we can't have gas-fired power plants, combined cycle plants, here in West Virginia and throughout the region that are supplying electricity to the people who need it, who don't want to have those power plants. But we also need other sources of electricity for when the gas becomes expensive again, for when the gas is not available because of the constraints of the infrastructure. And I see that continuing to be coal, as I described in my testimony.
I'll follow up later with you.
Yeah, let me ask you, following up on that, Mr. Keffer, we're not building another plant like Longview in this country at this time, correct?
Unlike the Germans, unlike the Japanese, unlike the Chinese, and people in India and across the world, no, we're not.
That's what I'm going to ask you. Where are they building them? So you got my every place but here. So you,
unbelievably, because in fact some of these countries like Germany and Japan have very restrictive climate control plans in place, even more so than what we would have here under the Clean Power Plan. And yet their mix of energy will include coal-fired power plants like Longview or more advanced plants than Longview.
Is the reason that we're not building them here, is it the expense, the regulatory environment, the fear of the unknown, or a little bit of each?
Well, right now we've got the regulatory environment that mm-hmm. is clearly a block. It's mm-hmm. It's not part of the Clean Power Plan, but the carbon new source rule, which is an adjunct to it, would make it so that to build in Longview, you would have to incorporate carbon capture and sequestration. And there aren't investors who are willing to take that kind of risk at this point in time because, and I know this is subject to litigation, but I'll just say what I think, it's really not commercially feasible at
right.
this point in time. Much more work.
Go to Mississippi.
Well, that's a different type of plant, but
right.
it also shows how difficult it is to make big leaps in
right.
the power industry. We made some incremental changes and leaps with Longview, and they were difficult enough to be able to make to see the results that we're seeing now. We had to reinvest additional amounts. But those huge leaps, which also people talk about renewables and talk about battery storage, that's another very, very large step into the future that we probably won't see for some time to come.
That is an interesting technology, too, on the renewable side with the battery storage. Dr. Deskins, let me ask you, you mentioned in your, just briefly, that your projections for natural gas is that that industry will take back off. I don't even know what the price, I know it's been very, very low. There's a lot of wells that are shut in. A lot of our companies, unfortunately, have laid off a lot of people. What makes you make that projection that it's going to get more? Does that mean the price is going to go up? Because we know we have the supply. Is it because LNG is going to be coming on?
Sure. What we see with natural gas is not surprising or not really bad. And the good thing is productive capacity with natural gas has outstripped our infrastructure, which is a good thing, right, for productive capacity to grow that much. But over time, I mean, the result is right now we have a glut of natural gas in this part of the country because of that productive capacity with their infrastructure constraints. But as infrastructure improves to get natural gas where it needs to be across the country geographically, as infrastructure improves to get gas to where it needs to be in terms of industry in manufacturing, both of those are going to help improve the natural gas situation. And as we can move forward with the export of liquefied natural gas to Europe, that's going to improve. All those things will expand. Effectively, those three things are expanding the market for natural gas from this region. That will lead to price appreciation over the long run. And that's something that's going to benefit natural gas and coal both as those natural gas prices go up. As a matter of fact, one of our top sources of optimism in our coal forecast is if natural gas prices are even higher than we expect. That's
right.
Going to be a source of optimism for coal, too.
Right, right. Mr. Hedrick, in terms of both you and Dr. Anderson talked about the Shell investment, and I know that was on hold for, what, 3 or 4 years before they made the announcement?
They made a final investment decision within the last 6 months. They're on an 18-month string at that point to actually start spending significant dollars in their terms with regard to multi-billion-dollar investment. I think they're in right now more than $100 million in prep for the site and engineering.
What would you point to that kind of was the tipping point for them to go ahead and make that final decision? I know they pulled out of Alaska on a very significant project they had going there for, gosh, I think decades. Do you have any – I'm going to ask you Dr. Anderson too, but Mr. Hedrick, do you have any opinion?
It was the assurance that they had predictability of supply of the raw material and predictability of demand for the product. I mean, those are the two key attributes that they had to have to make a multi-billion-dollar investment without making the decision to put in pipelines just to supply themselves and the decision to latch on to long-term contracts, which I'm not aware of their long-term contracts, but I want to imply that I am, but without some surety that they're going to have long-term supply for raw materials and offtake, it's a hard decision to make. And it would appear that they have those locked down now.
Dr. Anderson, do you have anything to add there?
Well, I agree with Steve's comments. I would say that additionally, Shell is investing in one step further downstream than just the cracker. And the final product is polypropylene pellets or small balls that they can sell directly in the market.
For plastics? Is that what that's?
Plastics, yeah, for people to directly mold. So that's one aspect of it. Additionally, you know, I would hate to say that the Pennsylvania tax credit that they have was a pretty big carrot for them, which would amount to about $1.7 billion over the life of the plant in terms of the ethane feedstock and knowing that they have a raw material that would be readily available, as Steve mentioned.
And that comes down to creating predictability, right? Mm-hmm. And predictability in supply, predictability in costs, and from a tax base, predictability in revenue generation associated with the facility. I think that the other states, Ohio and West Virginia, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania, in fact, would appreciate further predictability with regard to PHMSA and what they would do across the long haul with regard to our interstate pipeline system, and specifically as we talk about six-pack pipe from Monaca, Pennsylvania, across West Virginia and Ohio down to Catlettsburg, Kentucky. There has to be predictability for the midstream players to come in and construct such or make such an investment for the very same reasons that we're talking about with regards to Shell.
So that's refining into gasoline then you're talking about?
No, ma'am.
At Catlettsburg?
At Catlettsburg, they do have a refinery. They also have a propane to propylene manufacturing facility.
Do you want me to tell you the chemistry of that?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. I'll let Senator Manchin do that.
It's interesting that a very, very propylene back into Neal, West Virginia, to make polypropylene, which further goes into the market. This is not, I don't want to pretend that we've presented to you novel testimony, really. It's proven that this works, and it's proven that it's good for the Appalachian Basin and for the nation.
Yeah, so. Thank you. Senator Manchin?
It's frustrating for, I know for myself, and I'm sure for Senator Capito at times, they believe because we come from West Virginia, we represent West Virginia, that we don't care about the environment. And you'll have people, you know, kind of pigeonhole you on that. And we kept saying, listen, the bottom line is that we're looking at a products that we have, that we've been able to do it, and the rest of the world is using, still using coal. And I haven't spoken, there's utility people out here right now, I haven't spoken to one utility person, whether it's in our region or around the country, that believes that the portfolio they have that they're working with now is one of a business portfolio that they will decide it on. They believe that they've been forced because of the federal government regulations to fuel switch and put all eggs in one basket, which could be detrimental to the reliability, but also, most important, to the pricing that keeps us competitive as a country. Those are the things that we're talking about. So 94% of our electricity in West Virginia comes from coal. We're switching it rapidly, very rapidly. As we do that, how vulnerable does it make us from the standpoint to be able to create the stability that we would like to have in manufacturing bases? Why haven't we expanded off of the off of our chemical valley that we have? We have a tremendous chemical footprint in West Virginia, but there are no pun meant here. They're a shell of what they used to be. They're all at 50% less than what their footprint. How come those aren't developing? Why aren't we, our synergies put on that to bring those back? I know we're starting to use down the new one we just talked about, Steve. And Dan, I would ask you, as far as on the workforce, what are we doing to our workforce? I'm more concerned today than I've ever been in the state of West Virginia when we're under 50% of the people that are eligible to be working as adults working and performing.
Well, thank you for that question, Senator. In the trades, we're trying several programs to
your apprentice programs and all that. Yeah,
apprenticeship programs. We have how much hard hats, our returning vets. We get them in there. We try and develop technology to take those who, at one time, the job may have been too physical, but to lessen that challenge so that people who have some minor handicaps can do some of the trade works and stuff, so they can be productive instead of saying, "I'm unable to work." But all of our programs have things like that in place that we try and work with those who have any disadvantage at all that can become a productive, successful tradesman. There's a lot of jobs nowadays with technology and stuff that are more using your mind, not your hands so much. You have to have the basic understanding of math and science and things like that, but there's prospects for those folks like that. So we're trying to do the trades too. Make sure we give those folks an opportunity, not just saying because you're not 250 pounds, 6 foot tall, you can't be an iron worker. That's not true in today's world because of technology. Mm-hmm. So our trades are doing that there, and we hope to bring more people in. And 10 years ago, quite frankly, didn't have the opportunity.
Mr. Keffer, if I could ask you, on the plant, Longview, you were kind enough to have both of us and tremendous tours that we had there. That plant there, it was not encouraged by the federal government for you to build that plant, correct?
Oh, no. No, not at all.
If anything, they fought you all every step of the way and probably increased the cost by...
We benefited from being located here in West Virginia.
Yes.
For sure.
Now, with that being said, that plant also, you're saying you can gas fire that plant also?
We can gas fire up to 20% of its heat.
So you can basically have a multifaceted plant that produces off of gas, taking advantage of gas prices versus coal prices, and more reliable.
That's exactly right.
And that's not encouraged either.
If it's a coal-fired plant and it's got a steam generator like ours, it couldn't be built at this point because of the regulation that's now in litigation.
Gotcha.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's the clean power plan?
Yeah, yes.
And you're a merchant plant?
We are a merchant plant.
You want to explain the? You might want to explain just for the record.
So, yes, every day.
You're on the market.
We bid into the market in BJM, which is the area that includes West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, a good bit of Illinois and Indiana. And they are the BJM then buys all the power wholesale and then redistributes it to the utilities.
So you get no guaranteed pricing by PSC or any of that?
There is never guaranteed pricing. That is correct.
And you're able to compete in the marketplace. And what's your capacity now? What are you all producing? What capacity rate?
We're producing more than what we've said our net is.
I got you.
We're 700 megawatts, and during the hot days this summer, we've been...
you're able to sell all your power.
A bit. We're up to about 710 from time to time, just to be able to get those extra dollars out of our generation. Yes.
And my time, let me just kind of ask one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Deskins, Dr. Deskins, on the economy is what we're worried about. How in the world do we jumpstart this economy? And right now, I've been challenged a lot by people saying, I'm not sure you're going to have ample workforce. Do you see that as a concern that we may have, and how do we turn that around as quickly as possible?
Well, the first part of that question is easy. That is a desperate concern. I constantly talk about we want good transportation infrastructure. We want good tax climate. All these things are important. But if a firm isn't confident that it can find the workers that it needs who are healthy, well-skilled, well-educated, well-trained, and drug-free, then all the good, positive tax climate infrastructure, all these other things aren't going to matter if a business isn't confident that it's going to find the workers that it needs. I think education, training, health, human capital, drug abuse, I think these are probably the most important concern that we have going forward. And I frequently cite this labor force participation rate or this employment to population ratio as the key concern for West Virginia going forward. But it's not easy. We have so many challenges with regards to brain drain. Many of the young men and women who we pull out of high school from West Virginia, who we do give a good college education to, many of them just find that it makes more sense for them to take a job in Ohio, PA, Virginia, wherever. This all works together. I mean, if we can create a healthier economy, then those young men and women will be more inclined to stay here, and that'll help reverse many of our human capital brain drain problems. There's no easy answer. We have to focus on the basics, but we do need to keep our attention on health, drug abuse, education, and cultivating opportunities. And the clearest, most short-term opportunities are in energy to make it make more sense for our young people to stay here and for people to migrate here. But there's no silver bullets because it's a daunting challenge with 53% of our adult population wanting to have a job, lowest number in the nation. We've been dead last in that statistic every year since 1976. It's a challenge.
Do you have any more questions? I have a quick two quick questions. My first question is, I hear a lot of, I'll set it up, I hear a lot of optimism about where we can go because we're blessed. We have these resources. We have a willing, I think, more entrepreneurial spirit now to try to look at different and new ways to use this. My concern is if we only talk about it and don't actually act on it in terms of the infrastructure, getting back to the original topic of discussion. If we just say, yes, we do need some more pipelines, but can't attract the investment. Yes, we need a storage area, but we can't attract the investment. My concern is, do you see, and I guess, Dr. Anderson, I would ask you this, do you see a scenario where if we hesitate too long, we could, again, see our resource going somewhere else, being used all over, like our coal basically has been for years? I mean, we use a lot of it here, but we export a heck of a lot of it all around the country. Can you speak to that?
Senator Capito, yes, I completely agree with you. And if we don't act quickly in this region and in this state, then pipelines will be built to Philadelphia, Sarnia, Ontario, and the Gulf of Mexico. And so what in this region, what we're trying to do to be active about turning this around is lowering all the barriers, having a predictable and consistent permitting environment. Those sorts of things are exactly what we need to do to lower the barrier for private industry. And then on the other side, what we're trying to do is catalyze that private investment through showing where the opportunities are. And as Dr. Deskins mentioned, we need to work on the workforce challenge as well. But I completely agree with you. If we don't act now, then we will continue just to export our raw materials.
Right. I know there's some other opportunities in terms of a cracker. Obviously, the one in Parkersburg been talked about for several years is still on hold. But there's also, I think, great hope that across the Archmore Bridge in Moundsville, over there in Ohio, FirstEnergy has cleared a site there of a former power plant. And I have great hopes that that will develop. And I think, you know, if we could grab those investments, I think some of these other things can follow. But I don't have any other questions.
My only question is just the curiosity. If you were in our position, we could go back, or you could give us a situation where we could go back to Washington and make any type of a recommendation for a change, and that change could happen. What would be your recommendation for us to do, for not just West Virginia, but for our country? Basically, if we're going back and looking at economic vitality, every part in the country wants more jobs. I don't think any other part of the country needs jobs as bad as we need them right now. But so if you're going to recommend one thing to Senator Capito and myself, and you and we could change that, what would we go back and change? What would you ask? What would your question be for us to change? We'll just start down. Dan, do you have any?
Yeah, I would like to, and maybe part of this ties in what we said there a minute ago about the wages and the drug tests and all that. I would like to somehow come up with something that says, you know, when these projects come up, we put local workers on them. And when Dr. Deskin said, we're talking about competing with Ohio and Pennsylvania, that's true. People go there to work because anybody will go to work where they can make more money. And when we hold wages down and expect more, then people are going to go somewhere else. So I guess my question would be, if there's enough money to invest in infrastructure, you know, from the government to make the state in a position where it needs to bring all this together, then I think that's a good thing. And then if you put some caveat on there that we use local workers to do it and that they be drug-free, you know, I think that's a great start. And I did want to make the comment, we talked about the trades and there were some questions about drug-free workers, that we have less than 3% failure in our drug testing programs. And when we go to these folks' facilities to work, we have drug testing prior to and random while they're there. And we have less than 3% failure. And the reason for that, I believe, is it's a risk and reward. These are good paying jobs. People don't want to lose them. They don't want to bust out on drug tests to lose a job that's paying them a good living. So I think the two kind of go together, and I would have to ask you to, mm-hmm. if you could, to invest in West Virginia for the federal and the infrastructure.
You're saying make sure that any jobs that we could bring here that are going to be West Virginia jobs first.
Local jobs, local people. I mean, I believe it, yeah. And I believe in the drug testing requirement on the project.
Yeah. Jeff?
I would hope that we could use the opportunity with the change of administration, regardless of which direction it goes, to step in and settle the Clean Power Plan litigation, make changes to the framework of that allow us to get going on building new advanced coal plants, but also deal with the issue, the very real issue that's been recognized in the country of climate control.
Steve?
So sometimes I'm into a little bit of boldness, as you've known me over the years. And when I was in the Army, I had tanks, M1A1 Heavy Commons, and a great piece of gear. And the tank commander has at his disposal, or at her disposal, once we move forward, the opportunity to grab a commander's override, it's called, associated with that tank, and pivot the turret on their own and make a decision to redirect the pathway of the gun, if you will. So. What I would advise, if it's even feasible and possible, that the commander's override be grabbed by the federal government, work with the four state governments involved in this, and pivot this. We need 49% of this brought forward as part of the public investment associated with this. The private sector needs to come forward with 51% right now. And that is a bold shift in the manner of our thinking. What we want, but we're staring at adversity beyond that which we have seen in a generation. Southern West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky are being crushed right now, and social problems that come along with the declining education, increased drug problems, and the lack of opportunity and pride to be able to work they're going to tumble, and they're going to go further and further and further. The amount of money that we're going to spend across the next 20 years in supporting people who want to work but can't and experience all of these problems I think is going to, we could dwarf that by a simple investment right now between the four states and the federal government.
Chad?
I think we're getting regulated out of business to some degree. From the people that I've talked to, the rules for all the different regulations we have aren't necessarily clear. There's a lot of overlap on who has jurisdiction over what. So I think that whole process could be streamlined. Whenever it delays construction, construction costs in the wintertime go up approximately 15%. So they're banking on that because of different permits and stuff that they have to have. So that's probably the biggest one most important for us.
I would say, of course, thank you for that question, by the way. This is a fantastic question. I appreciate you offering me an opportunity to weigh in. But I would say, first off, of course, any positive regulatory policies surrounding clean coal technology, natural gas policies, research and development in those areas, of course, are one of our most clear short-term ways to prosperity in this state. But let me just say, I really, really appreciated your comment at the very beginning about returning Vietnam veterans. I've never heard it put that way, but that's a great way to think about how West Virginia, supplied the nation's energy for so many years, but how we have not been thanked enough for our contribution to our fundamental moving the nation forward. So with that in mind, I would try to do what I can to really communicate the state that we really find West Virginia in, especially the Great Depression that we find in six counties, and I would call for any help that we can get from Washington with our drug crisis, with our health crisis, with our education crisis, and with our significant infrastructure needs. All those those are such major problems, it's laughable for me to call it short-term issues, but those are important. That's my answer.
I think with the raw materials we have in this region, there are really three ways to get it to the population centers where it's used. West Virginia doesn't have a lot of population, but as Steve mentioned, within one shift's drive is about 2/3 of the population of the United States and 1/3 of Canada. So there are the three ways to move those raw materials are either pipes, wires, or roads. And so ultimately what we want to do is upgrade the materials to where we end up stressing our road infrastructure because we're shipping so many end and finished goods. And so I think we see within the state of West Virginia the road infrastructure, a lot of wear and tear, and because of the decreased tax revenues that we've seen, a lot of wear on the road infrastructure. And so I would encourage one way to help spur the investment of either pipes, wires, or roads is to lower the barrier for the regulatory environment to where it's predictable. And so we've heard this message a few times of the unpredictability of the regulatory environment, which leads itself to the unpredictability and the ability to get capital. And so when you go to an investor and there's an unpredictable regulatory environment, such as one of the at the moment, that leads to a difficulty in getting investment. And so leveling the playing field in terms of the predictability of the regulatory environment, I think is a huge barrier to cross.
Let me just one final comment from me before Senator Capito wraps this up. The thing that I was most appalled by and why I'm most upset from the present administration under President Obama, there was no plan. There was no plan. What do you do when an area is absolutely economically destroyed, knowing that this major policy shift of this moving away from fossil that he would like to do in such a rapid way by turning the EPA loose, and I know we've been criticized for saying war on coal, I don't know what else to call it. I really don't, because it's been so singly targeted in the Appalachian region. So I'm trying to be as respectful as I can and trying to get policies forward. So I've come to the conclusion of this. The only way that we're ever going to is follow the dollars, the tax credits, extenders. They've been pouring more and more tax credits and extenders into renewables. And the only thing I'm going to say, if that's the policy direction, and we can't collectively stop some of this other thing when you have an administration desire to do something as they've done, we could at least say this. It makes all the sense in the world. If you're going to use these tax extenders, they call them tax extenders, they're credits. They give them credits if they do certain things in certain fields. So if they're moving to solar or hydro or wind and all this, those credits should only be used in a germane energy that's where the losses were. So if the losses came from areas such as West Virginia and such as Southwest Virginia and such as Kentucky, those credits have to be used there. It makes all the sense in the world. I'm going to do everything I can to shut this system down the next time, because trust me, they love tax credits. The wind people ain't letting tax credits go. Solar's not letting tax credits go. So I'm saying, how do you argue against at least using the credits if you're going to get them? We'll build the best windmills, Danny. Our guys can build windmills. We can build solar. We can build anything you want. Just give us a chance. And that's what I am most upset about, is no plan. There was no plan for a major policy shift in energy. And that's what we've got to correct, I think, as quickly as possible to give us all a chance to survive in this tough area. So, Senator, thank you so much again for this. And we are having Secretary Manise Kim right now scheduled for the 12th.
To Morgantown.
We're going to do this because he needs to see what Nettle's doing. He needs to see what you're doing, Jeff, at Longview, and basically what we can do in a balanced approach. So all of you will be invited, and we hope everybody shows up. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I know the last thing's only the last thing till it's the last thing. So I'm going to say one thing, since it kind of got on my mind, something that Senator Manchin was saying. I've been on an effort, too, with, and I believe Senator Manchin's on this, although I won't speak for him, but I know Senator Portman in Ohio is, to try to even this tax credit thing. So if you're going to go and build a coal-fired power plant and you can use carbon capture and sequestration, which Jeff has said is not occurring right now because it's not economically or probably technological feasible, when it gets there, let's put them on an even tax credit playing field so that fair is fair. And it doesn't exist right now, and I think it would also get to some of the greater goals of cleaner, more efficient energy production. With that is the last thing. And so I would like to thank again Senator Manchin. As you can see, we work very well together, and we have I think a unity of thought in this area. I'd like to thank the witnesses, our hosts, and the committee. I would like to thank my staff, Jan Bruner and Kaylin Billingsley, for all their hard work of putting this together. And I would also like to thank the chair and ranking member of the full committee, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska and Maria Cantwell from the state of Washington. We could not have this here in West Virginia without their consent, so I want to thank them and the full staff as well. Thank you all, and with that, I'll adjourn this committee.
Thank you. Good job.
Good last question.